It's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I am your thankfully temporary host, Stephen Thompson. Our usual host, Linda Holmes, is at home extensively documenting the contents of her sinuses. This week, one of the best-reviewed TV shows of the summer is not on your TV. We will talk about Orange is the New Black, and then we will go on to explore pseudonyms inspired by a new J.K. Rowling book. And as always, we will close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I edit movies coverage for NPR.org.
Glenn Weldon, what do you do?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And as mentioned, our usual host, Linda Holmes, is absent this week. We have a special guest and a familiar one this week. Jess Gittner, what do you do at NPR?
I produce this podcast and Morning Edition.
And a fine job you do. So we thought we would start off with a new show, a Netflix original series called Orange is the New Black, which several people in this room were extremely excited about.
And whose title I cannot hear without thinking that it's going to end up being Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit.
Right.
Right, exactly. It is a long and cumbersome title. But we thought we would talk about it because, among other things, you know, the Netflix original series, Netflix did House of Cards, Netflix did the fourth season of Arrested Development, mm-hmm. and a few other shows. This one really came out of nowhere. There was not a lot of advance hype for it, but there is suddenly a tremendous amount of interest. And I'm actually going to start by asking Jess for her thoughts on Orange is the New Black. Now, Jess, you've seen the entire series, correct?
I took down 13 episodes. I skipped sleeping on Friday.
Wow.
And in a period of less than 24 hours, I consumed all 13. Well, let's start with just giving people an idea what the show is about.
Right.
It's based on a memoir by this woman named Piper Kerman. It's so the show is based on true life. And it's basically this woman who is sort of bougie, you know,
right.
Whole food shopper.
Preppy.
Runs an artisanal soap business
right.
with her best friend.
You're doing a juice cleanse in the early going.
And a very pretty.
Very pretty,
Very
yeah.
pretty, you know, conventionally pretty blonde, kind of prim
mm-hmm.
woman.
Went to Smith College and now is engaged to a man, Larry, who's played
by
Jason Biggs from American Pie. So she goes to prison 10 years after essentially transporting what I understand is drug money over
right.
international borders. So basically the show picks up where she is going to prison, where coincidentally her former lesbian lover
and co-conspirator,
yes, played by Laura Prepon from That 70s Show, is also incarcerated. So for various reasons, I was interested in the show.
Oh, list them, Jess. Please do list them.
One, obviously, having to do with the lesbian plot of some
mm-hmm.
sort. Now, but I want to say, the show is not a show about lesbians. It's,
right.
it's a show that includes a cast who
a
is
mix.
Diverse, a black, Latino.
There is a transgender character on the
transgender
show.
Transgender character. And then, as one may assume about a women's prison, fact or fiction, many lesbians. I came to the show not knowing much about it, have not read the memoir.
And it should be noted, the creator of the show is Jenji Cohen
from
Weeds.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a certain amount of interest in the show based on that, but very little had been said about it before it was dumped en masse on the public, all 13 episodes up on Netflix.
I mean, I really enjoyed the show. I thought this is a great example of how to include lesbians in a cast and not say this is only for lesbians, as I would say the L word or
right.
that kind of show is. It's picked up for season 2. I'm glad that's happening. Now, it is based on a memoir, so we do know a little bit about what should happen. Now, whether they're going to take creative liberties, I hope they do, because if you just Google the author,
yeah,
Piper
spoiler
Kerman,
alert, she has a Wikipedia entry.
Yeah, and she
is,
lives. And she lives, and she is married to Larry Smith now. Now,
yes.
Whether that happens in the show, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine they'll continue to take more creative liberties. Glenn, what did you think of Orange is the New Black?
Liked it. I also powered through all 13 episodes.
Wow,
it wasn't a question of powering through, because I really, really loved it. We have to assert here that the jokiness of its title and the jokiness of its premise, I mean, we're all reaping the whirlwind of Breaking Bad, where there's like
mm-hmm.
this huge high concept that kicks off a thing.
Mm-hmm.
This show is a lot more nuanced than you would imagine from the title. And it gets past all these clichés pretty quickly I think on the strength of its performances. The premise is, Caged Heat 2, Martha Stewart goes to jail. And if you take things like plot points from the old syndicated television show Prisoner Cell Block H, which was an Australian syndicated... Are you familiar with this, Jess?
I'm not.
An Australian syndicated soap opera set in a women's prison that was syndicated here in the States between 1970 and 1986. If you take the plot points and just sort of map them over this, you're going to hit a lot because it's a small environment, a hermetic environment, and there's only so many things that can happen. But what really drives it is the strength of these performances. Taylor Schilling, as Piper, the main character, is asked to do this thing over and over again, and she knocks it out of the park every time. It's a kind of acting we've only seen in the last 20 years or so because it is a television show, which means lots of close-ups, so it's not theatrical acting. And it's also, we're getting to know these characters over the course of a long time, longer than it would take for a movie. And so much happens in Taylor Schilling's face. Many times she is asked to react to something. We see the reaction she knows is wanted from her, but we also see what she wants to say, and the camera just pauses, lets us see it happen, and then she makes a choice.
Yeah, this is a technique that I think TV writers are beginning to explore actively. They learned it from directors and good actors. Exactly what you're saying is that people are doing the subtext and the beat work.
Right.
And they're really paying attention to it. So the camera can catch that entire inner monologue that's happening with a character. And right now, the writers on this show and the actors on this show and the directors on this show are really... They're all sort of in lockstep, and they're working really well together, and I hope that they stay as interested in this kind of storytelling as they seem to be in the first few episodes.
Well, I think an important point about Taylor Schilling's acting, as Glenn sort of implied, Taylor Schilling is an audience surrogate in many, many ways. You know, she's not an entirely sympathetic character.
Right.
But she is a stand-in for how a lot of people would feel in this situation. They have a little bit of fun at her expense with the artisanal soap business and her iPhone and that she's going to miss Mad Men and the things that she's fretting over. But at the same time, you know, she sort of represents what somebody who never thought she would be going to prison would say and do and put in that position.
Yeah. Now,
I have only seen 3 episodes of this show. I was afraid that when I talked about this show, it was just going to be a hysterical spew of superlatives.
Right.
I freaking loved this show. I am absolutely knocked out by it, and I cannot wait to binge watch the next 10 episodes.
Yeah, I felt very much the same. There's very little that I have to complain about as yet.
2 or 3?
I'm 2 episodes in. But it's clear already that the creators really want you to invest deeply, not just in the sort of core ensemble, but in the wider range of characters here. They keep giving you these insights into the inner lives of these characters, even the ones who aren't necessarily central to Piper's story. It's Red, who runs the kitchen at the prison, is a main character. She's played by
Kate Mulgrew.
Who's having a great time playing a Russian with a terrible red dye job. There are all these other characters, and structurally, the show involves a lot of flashbacks. They'll hit a key emotional moment, and that will trigger a memory for a character. The connection between the flashback and what's just been said is always really tight, at least so far, which is another thing I like about the writing of the show.
And Mike Katzef actually tweeted this at me. He compared the way they handled the flashbacks to Lost, which I thought was really...
Well, you have everybody sealed in a place, but the world is much larger because you're constantly jumping out of it.
The difference is these are asserted much more lightly. You're in and out
and
of
directly.
These flashbacks and directly.
And there's not as much
And fuzziness. It's important because, I mean, I bailed out of Lost pretty early because I became aware that the producers were interested in things that I was completely not. So, for example, they would spend a lot of time flashing back and asking questions like, you know, who will Kate choose? And I was like, there's a smoke monster that eats people. And they'd say, boy, Jack has some daddy issues. And I'd be like, there's a smoke monster that eats people. And then they'd say, this is why. And in one episode, they finally said, and this is why Kate carries a toy plane around with her. And I was like, is it a smoke toy plane? Does it eat people? Because there was nothing happening in the flashbacks. I mean, there was all people having feelings, but it didn't really build onto the island because the island was such a weird thing. This all flows much more dramatically, and they're short.
Yeah, it should be noted, the way they're structuring it, there's an arc through through the season of Piper's journey.
Mm-hmm.
But they also, I gather, I've only seen the first three, but I gather they continue this all through the series, that each episode is telling her story, but weaving in the story of a peripheral character. Mm-hmm. So in episode two, as Trey said, it's Red who runs the kitchen. In episode three, oh my God, it is an absolutely incredible performance by Laverne Cox as a transgender transgender firefighter turned hairstylist, and weaves together her story throughout, you know, while still telling the story of Piper. I mean, I just was so incredibly knocked out by the acting and how instantly affecting it is. You know, a character you've seen for a couple minutes who you suddenly care about very deeply, and you're getting not only her backstory, but how her story is affecting the people around her in ways that capture why she's in prison, mistakes that she has made, and people she has hurt.
Right. And that kind of widens out to this idea of how this show addresses sexuality. Mm-hmm. It just in general is so spot on and so rarely seen. I mean, the concept of lesbianism and the concept of bisexuality and the fluidity of sexuality.
Yeah, I think they really do so that so well.
Smart. It's so matter-of-factly asserted, and as sexuality does, it colors relationships, it shapes relationships, and it shifts relationships over the course of this series. Shift in very important, sometimes surprising, often subtle ways.
Mm-hmm.
In a way more subtly than I've seen on a lot of television shows. Which I also had that same feeling of excitement, because I wasn't getting force-fed a lot of exposition plot points. Thank God there was no voiceover. I kept waiting for it to get
right. Yeah.
But there isn't, because they
trust. Yeah, that's a huge, huge feature.
They trust the actors.
Well, they also do something that I found interesting, comparing our Netflix series, comparing it to, oddly enough, the fourth season of Arrested Development, which is stitching together a large story by having each contained episode be largely about one character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting how Arrested Development, under the weight of the seasons before it, in that way, it's where it's constantly having to call back old jokes. And from the way the show was made, that most of the actors aren't in the same place at the same time. And it's interesting how many, how much I think, I mean, I'm not all the way through Arrested Development, but sort of this show is doing that thing where each episode is about a different character much more seamlessly.
You know, one thing I was concerned about a couple episodes into the show is that this sense of danger starts to dissipate as she acclimates to her surroundings. Then it struck me that that's exactly what happens. When all of a sudden you're entering a completely strange environment, you start to be able to localize where the threats are.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what she does. But that risks decreasing the stakes, decreasing the tension. But they always have found a way, through this first season, of constantly getting her back in danger. Now, in many cases, they do that by having her say or do something really stupid.
Right.
You can do that in the first season. I don't want to see that in the second season or the third season or fourth season, because it just seems like a too convenient way to keep ratcheting up the tension.
Yeah, it is only in the first couple of episodes there are moments where it becomes clear that this is a closed system, as we have said, where there are rules.
Right.
You seem sweet. You really do, honey. Well, I can't do because I'm sorry. Not in here. Might not look like it, but there's rules in this place. The most important of which is, the second you're perceived as weak, you already are.
And
blah, blah.
Yeah, I know, right? There's your Kate Mulgrew.
Yeah.
And I hear what you're saying. What I suspect is that increasingly, she'll get to know the rules. She'll be like, what's her name on Weeds, Botwin, and she will become a danger to others and to herself in a different way. And then, of course, it's prison, so there are going to be sort of unexpected threats, right, eventually,
yeah.
I'm hoping.
And ways of weaving in more characters.
Sure.
I mean, this is not Gilligan's Island, where it's not going to be difficult to import new people into this show if need be, and export people off of the show. You hope.
Right.
You want some of these people to get out of this place. Mm-hmm. Not every, it's interesting to me, one mistake they don't make. It's a fish-out-of-water story. And part of what you're getting in the beginning, in the very first episode, is, gosh, she doesn't belong there.
Mm-hmm.
Why is she there? And there's a scene where she's meeting with the warden, and he sort of says, like, well, this is a gigantic waste of taxpayer dollars. And they talk a little bit about inequality in sentencing. They weave in a little bit of commentary there. But what I love about it is, as they're dishing out these backstories, you don't have a story of a largely innocent person who just got swept up with the wrong crowd, you know, 10 years ago, and now she's, you know, she's this. And she's in here with all these people who deserve it.
Right.
She's in here with all these bad people.
Right.
You get the different stories of desperation and bad decisions and bad luck mm-hmm. that land each of these people here. And you get a sense after a while that one of the things the show is saying is she's no better
right.
than these other people. Right. And so you're not, yes, she's the audience surrogate, but you're being pulled into this world and understanding that everybody's there for a cocktail of reasons, not all of which are this person is bad.
Good, this person is bad. Yeah, this is my sense. Now, I grant you, I have not read the memoir. I don't know if any of you have. But through a very odd set of coincidences, which I just found out about today, the real Piper is a friend of a friend. She's involved in a communications firm that does a lot of business in New York and here in D.C. And there was a long conversation with her on Talk of the Nation when her memoir came out, which I listened to a bit of. And it seems to me like she's in exactly that business of sort of explaining the kinds of circumstances, or at least communicating that notion that there's a variety of reasons people get caught up in the system in this way. And so she seems like a sort of interesting, fascinating person who learned a lot from this process.
She was interviewed by The Rumpus, I think it was, when the book came out. And she made exactly Stephen's point, which is that she saw people in the joint who kept identifying with the guards and not the people around them. And she saw how miserable they were. And she resolved that she would not do that. Of course, she belongs in here. And she deserves her fate. And she shares that fate with everybody else in there. One thing, can we talk about race? Can the four most egregiously white people I know talking about race for a bit.
I am half Chinese.
All right, good.
Okay. So I'm bringing the diversity to this group here.
As many points...
I'm actually half Angle and half Sesh.
Sure.
Nice. Yeah.
As many points as the show gets for me for on its just incredibly spot-on, matter-of-fact, unfussy way of dealing with sexuality, its take on race seems a little tidy to me, a little well-scrubbed. And, you know, this might be a function of the fact that I saw this arc happen really quick because I was mainlining these episodes one after the other. So a lot of these changes that occur over the season happen to me very quickly. So all of a sudden we see her a little bit later and she's sitting at a table with the black inmates, and that seemed a little like, well, I mean, they just had this incident before, so what's going on here? And so, you know, I'm basing this on my extensive knowledge of the federal penal system, but I mean, it just some of that seemed like it wasn't explored or touched on. And a point that Piper Kerman made in this interview that I read was that, you know, why is my story the one being told as opposed to the story of all these women around
her? Oh, and how awful would it be if it were the story of the heroic white lady who's thrown in with all these people who deserve it?
One of the answers is that her husband is an editor for various journals and is, you know, one of the people who created the six-word memoir. Right. You know, Larry Smith is a guy with connections, and, you know, she's got access to the channels of communication, so that's why her story is being told. Not that she's not good at what she does.
But in a meta sense, I mean, here are two things that this culture does not want to address, which is the penal system and race. And
right.
and the idea that we need Piper, a character named Piper. Smart move keeping the name Piper, by the way.
Right.
Really smart move.
Right name.
to bring it in, because, I mean, let's talk about the opening credits. The opening credits is of just these women staring out at you. It's just a series
just
of
flashing
of
faces.
Closing,
tight shots,
really
yeah.
tight shots on faces, on eyes,
yeah,
staring out at
tight
you.
Tight shots on eyes and mouths.
Yeah.
So it's seeing and speaking and seeing and saying, and we should do like 10 minutes just on that opening sequence, because there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. And for this kid who is less than comfortable with eye contact, it is something I zip through
and done. But you're zipping through the great Regina Spektor song.
The fantastic song.
Yeah.
Which is called You've Got Time.
The animals, trap, till the cages fall. The cages fall, the day is new. And everyone is waiting on you. And you've got time.
And written, you know, specifically for the opening credits. Of
right,
this
and, you know, with all the double meanings therein, time, one of the most used words in Shakespeare, by the way.
Think of all the roads, think of all their crossings. Taking steps is easy, standing still is hard.
So this thing was just dropped on us last week, all 13 episodes at once, and I'm only starting to see writing about it, and I'm waiting to see some kind of take about its race and its way it deals with race.
Because I haven't
still
seen that yet. We will.
Well, the first episode. I mean, the first episode, she gets to prison, and you know, her driver says, "We look out for our own."
Right.
Don't worry. It's tribal.
It's tribal, not racist. It's not racist.
And later, that same character, as she struggles with this, the same character who told her about the race situation told her,
"Black ladies just run against the other black ladies. My competition is Pennsylvania, but it don't matter because Red's gonna make all the white girls roll for me."
"Look, just pretend it's the 1950s. It makes it easier to understand."
"See, everyone elects a representative from their own tribe. White, black, Hispanic, golden girls, others. It's like student council."
"But how is that an effective system? Not every Hispanic person wants the same thing."
"Well, sure they do. They don't want to come to America."
"Jesus, your entire worldview is based on West Side Story, isn't it?"
"Can we get back to Lorna being racist? Just more of that, please."
Just go with it.
Yeah, so they're shorthanding it, and with any luck, we'll get to some deeper
wranglings. In peripheral characters, I mean, in these very brief scenes, and they don't really explain this, but one of the characters, Crazy Eyes, it's revealed that she has white parents. She's a black character with white parents, and she's into theater. And that's, they just move on, and I was fine with them just dropping that little bit of knowledge.
I do think it should be pointed out, Linda has talked on this show about limited roles for actresses.
Mm-hmm.
And the, was it Babe D.A. Driving Miss Daisy?
Yeah.
And the sheer number of great roles and great performances by women on this show is striking, to the point where one of the few flaws that I've found in the first three episodes that I've seen, because, and I've just, you know, riveted the entire time, is I feel like the male characters are very one-dimensional.
Yeah, right? At this point, the only male person who feels like a human being is the fiancé, of course. And he's giving a really nice performance, I think. Really low-key, affable, and they've set him up to be this great guy, and I hope to God he develops some feet of clay at some point, or at least some doubts.
There's some
good then,
but
good for you. You'll enjoy.
Uh-huh. But yeah, the other guys, the men within the system, the guards, and
the guards in particular are very one dimensional.
They're
right
sadistic.
Now.
They're jokers. They're losers. They're easily deceived.
But there's also the sweetheart. Mm-hmm. You know,
there is this again. I'm only two episodes in. Don't tell me too much.
No.
The babyface guard, mm-hmm, Bennett, who's clearly got a thing for one of Piper's roommates,
right,
is the one I'm most fascinated to sort of find out who he's going to turn out to be.
And if they explore the creepy power dynamics in that.
Yeah.
Right. Because I didn't read that as quite as good-hearted as, you know, maybe.
Yeah, that might be my least, that might be the biggest flaw of the show that I've seen so far, that little plot.
That's the one that, I agree.
I don't find that particularly sweet, that a prison guard in that, yeah.
Yeah, I guess they just had to go there. They needed, you know, for those that can't get into the little love.
Well, and I'm sure,
and
I'm sure it's
Laura Prepon and Taylor Schilling.
It should. This is an audio podcast. You did not see Jess waggle her eyebrows just now. Kind of in the way that Glenn Weldon waggled his eyebrows about Henry Cavill a few episodes ago.
It's the same kind of waggling.
Oh my.
All right. So have you, listener, watched Orange is the New Black yet? We all highly recommend that you do. I cannot express enough how fantastic this show is. But come to our Facebook page, facebook.com/PCHH, and let us know what you think of Orange is the New Black and the many issues that it raises. Our next topic is inspired by a recent news story about, now I said J.K. Rowling in the intro, but Trey informs me that it's J.K. Rowling.
I think.
So I'm
rolling like bowling.
So what we're going to do is you guys are going to pronounce it correctly, and I am going to instinctively pronounce it wrong for the duration of the podcast. Mm-hmm. But J.K. Rowling, up here, I'll do it right. J.K. Rowling announced in the last week or so that a book that has been out for a while called The Cuckoo's Calling, which had been credited to Robert Galbraith and has sold about 1,500 copies, was, in fact, by her, writing under a pseudonym. And we sort of thought that it would be interesting to talk about the pseudonym and some of the whys and wherefores and interesting pseudonyms throughout popular culture, because there are many. I'm going to go to Glenn first on this one.
Okay. I'm not calling shenanigans on this whole thing, but her book, The Cuckoo's Calling, came out in April. And as anybody whose book came out in April knows, all your sales are pretty much in that first month, and then things really take a nosedive. And so it just so happens that a reporter at the Times, the Sunday Times, tweeted how much he liked this book, and it doesn't seem like it was the work of an amateur. And then he got an anonymous tweet saying, it's J.K. Rowling. And then that person's Twitter stream disappeared. And so then they did a language analysis, and they found out, using not just this book, but some of the Potter books, but also The Casual Vacancy, which was the very successful book she came out with last year. So, you know, if you need something to goose your sales, that's a pretty good way.
Well, sure.
And, you know, this also...
But they could have goosed their sales by releasing it as a J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not like she
needs
anything
goosed.
Yeah,
I know,
exactly.
I know. But, I mean, the publisher needs it. But she said at the time that it was great to come out with a book without hype or expectation, and it was incredibly a pleasure to get feedback under a different name. So good for her. This also inspired a round of Twitter people saying, oh, by the way, my book was also written by J.K. Rowling. So I was trying to think of times where this kind of thing had happened before. I mean, there's the literary community is filled with pseudonyms of you know, pen names of authors, but that's not kind of what I was going for here.
Known quantities who have voluntarily taken on the cloak of anonymity.
Right. Stephen King took on the cloak of Richard Bachman because he was just writing books a lot, and he and his publisher were worried about saturating the market with Stephen King, the Stephen King brand. So he came out with Richard Bachman, and he followed it up. But he gave a fake author photo, and he kept constantly denied that he was Richard Bachman, even though their styles are very similar.
Right. it's hard to disguise over the course of a book.
And he wanted to see if he was just lucky or if there was something about his talent.
Right.
And it turned out that in his mind, he has talked about how he think Richard Bachman was added too early for him to really know. So he'll never really know because it didn't... Richard Bachman wasn't out there.
Well, there was certainly some speculation that Rowling did this because the reviews for her first post-Harry Potter book were not very kind.
Well, and dwelled endlessly on its
right.
comparing
on comparing contrast.
I mean,
right?
for Rowling, and,
wouldn't
and,
let it live on its own.
Right.
Well, and for Rowling and for King / Bachman, we're talking about a sort of a soft launch.
Yeah. Right.
You know, where you're putting it out there and just like, do people like it? And if they don't, but you know, it's a great way to uncontextualize your work,
right.
and I'm sure over time,
which is a time-honored use of the pseudonym, right? I mean, we go back to the Brontes,
right.
So yeah, so the Bronte sisters published a book of poetry using male names. So Charlotte was Currer Bell, Emily was Ellis Bell, and Anne was Acton Bell. Early on in his career, Charles Dickens was Boz, Washington Irving was Diedrich Knickerbocker, on and on like that. So it's usually a way, it's often a way anyway, to kind of get your work out there and not have your name attached to it.
Right.
Certainly Stan Lee came up with a pseudonym Stan Lee because he wanted to be a real novelist, and he didn't want his name associated with Stanley Lieber. He didn't want his name associated with these funny books. But we saw how that came out.
Well, and we've also got to talk about famous authors who have done erotic fiction under different names.
You're talking Anne Rambling.
Your Anne Rice. Harlan Ellison actually just, they're now reissuing some of his early work, these kind of pulp novels that he had written under a pseudonym, and for years really rejected and distanced himself from. And now, late in life, he has embraced this, a republishing of his work under a pseudonym. But it was work that was very different from what he wanted to write. So you certainly have your whether it's considered beneath the author,
sure.
you know, in one way or another, that it is a way for authors to experiment with other genres.
Authors in children's books or humor books often just do it for a lark. So L. Frank Baum had many, many pseudonyms. Edward Gorey, of course, he did it with a wink because all of his pseudonyms were basically, most of his synonyms were anagrams of his name. He also went out with, I think, Edward Blutig, which is the German word for Gorey. Dean Kuntz has many, many, many pseudonyms. I think that's probably just so people leave him alone. Stephen, can you talk a little bit about, like in the music industry, when it's done, it tends to be done with a wink. Like, what the hell happened with Garth Brooks? What was that about?
Okay, yeah. I had this on my
terrible
list.
Terrible hair.
I had my list. Now, yeah. I had this on my list. Now, Garth Brooks, it doesn't entirely count as a pseudonym because his face is on the cover of the album. Was it Garth Brooks is Chris Gaines or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Chris Gaines is his like kind of rockin' alter ego.
Maybe it's the books, maybe it's the government and all the other crooks. Maybe it's the drugs, maybe it's parents. Maybe it's the gangs or the colors that we're wearing. Maybe it's the high schools, maybe it's the teachers. Tattoos, paint bombs underneath the bleachers. Maybe it's the music, maybe it's the crack. Maybe it's the Bible, or could it be the lack?
Come on! Basically, basically, his vision of an alter ego isn't that much from different from the vision of the evil twin, where it basically just has a small like a soul patch equals rocker.
Right, that is sash. Maybe.
And so
stepping out of the teleporter.
And that record is very, very maligned. It came out, what was it, mid-90s, and you know, as he was the biggest star in country music, a gigantic star, and he has always been a little bit of an envelope pusher within that world, kind of touching on issues of domestic abuse and whatever, you know, and not a strictly straightforward mainstream subject matter. But the Garth Brooks,
I think that's important, because Garth Brooks was always kind of the guy who was, he was the good guy. He was your drinking buddy, your friends in low places.
I got
guy.
Friends in low mm-hmm. places, and this record was designed to push beyond that, and I think potentially tentatively see if he could become a rock star in addition to a country star, and it was mostly laughed off,
right,
and viewed as silly. But that, I think, falls under the category a little bit more of disguises.
Okay.
And it doesn't have the anonymity to it the way, talking about other musical examples, The Residents,
sure,
or GWAR,
right,
or Daft Punk,
mm-hmm,
or Deadmau5.
Right.
You're simply putting on a mask. You're putting on a, if it's GWAR, you know, these ridiculous costumes and spurting blood into the audience. So the theatricality of the, you know, like the Blue Man Group,
sure,
almost, where you're putting on a fake face. And I feel like with a lot of these bands, it's more about the concept than simply hiding their actual identity. You can track down the identities of most of these artists. With somebody like The Residents, there really was this mystery for the long time. Like, who are these guys? You know, and you almost get the, like, are they actually super duper famous? No, sure, they are not. but I think that's interesting. And also, you know, drifting into movies, mm-hmm, you have your Alan Smithy,
sure,
which is the ultimate movie pseudonym when a director wishes to take his or her name off of the project because it has gone off the rails.
Oh,
and
wow.
So you put the name Alan Smithy on it,
right,
and that is a different kind of pseudonym. You know, we touched on a little bit with books when Anne Rice doesn't want this to be the Anne Rice porn book.
But Anne Rice, by the way, her real name is Howard Allen O'Brien.
I know.
Yeah. Right?
So it's no, it's not really surprising why she chose a new name.
You know,
well, she also wrote as Anne Rampling and as A.N. Rocalar,
right,
which I think were some of the,
wow,
the senior romantic stories. Joyce Carol Oates wrote Mysteries under a pseudonym or
That's
two,
right,
as
mm-hmm,
I recall. What strikes me across disciplines, though, is the sort of intersection of playful, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, wanting to have that disguise so as to be assessed on the merits.
Right.
It goes all the way back to something as, and this has only occurred to me just now, but I've been rereading the Game of Thrones books, and George R. R. Martin talks a lot in those books about knights who have jousted under masks and under blank shields that didn't have their own heraldry. They show up as mystery knights, they win the tournament, then they unveil themselves to be Lord so-and-so, who's terribly famous and wins lots of tournaments.
Right.
So there's something, I think, key to the sort of impulse to achieve that points in this direction, and I'm not sure I know what it is.
Well, it's funny you mentioned George R. R. Martin. That's actually a pseudonym. His real name is George R. Martin.
The world has changed so much that, you know, before, I can remember when XTC, the band XTC, mm-hmm, put out an album called Chips from the Chocolate Fireball, I think it was, under the name The Dukes of Stratosphere.
Yeah. Which is misspelled.
Misspelled in a wacky way. which was all psychedelic and things like that. You know, the music press wasn't about to break the... They were having fun with the mystery. So unless you could really do some digging, like old-fashioned shoe leather reporting, I guess, you weren't really sure. I mean, it sounded a hell of a lot like him. But, I mean, like, there was an element of mystery to that. Now, there wasn't something like that with David Bowie and Ziggy Stardust. Everybody kind of got the
name. Right. That's the pseudonym versus the disguise.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's no mystery. The mystery used to be harder to pierce, or at least you had a different relationship with the mystery. I mean, now it's Sasha Fierce, and Sasha Fierce isn't even a disguise, really. It's sort of a persona.
Right.
Well, I came up with some, as a non-reader like Stephen, although you have surprised me, Stephen, today. I am impressed.
I got layers.
Go
to
go.
Steal a line from Glenn Weldon.
I did pull out a few where I just thought, you know, good thing you chose that other name. Anne Rice was one, Howard Allen O'Brien, Portia de Rossi, her real name, Amanda Lee Rogers. Not quite as
exotic.
It's not exotic,
but it's pretty. It's a pretty
name. It's a perfectly
name.
Nice
it's
name,
fine.
But it's not Portia de Rossi.
It sounds almost Southern.
It
and
does.
And she's Australian.
It does, Amanda.
And then Judy Garland, Frances Ethel Gumm.
Yeah, Frances Gumm.
Trey knew that.
Okay.
Of course I knew that.
And then some fictional people who then had pseudonyms on TV or in books. Lord Voldemort, who was really Tom Riddle.
So you got a pseudonym
going
within,
back within, yeah. To J.K. Rowling. You know, you got your Don Draper, your Dick Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
More of an identity thing. Ron Swanson, his saxophone playing
alter
ego.
Duke Silver.
And finally, my favorite, do you remember George Costanza's pseudonym, which he frequently used?
No.
Vandelay?
No. Yeah, Art Vandelay.
Art Vandelay.
Oh, hello.
Art.
Mr. Vandelay, of course.
You two know each other? Mr. Pennypacker.
Yes. I wanted to stop by and make sure that my shark tank fixed it. Hello.
Mr. Pennypacker, this is Mr. Vandelay, and you know Mr. Varnson.
Varnson.
Pennypacker.
Vandelay.
Pennypacker. Varnson.
Vandelay.
My fave.
And there's a Simpsons where Homer changes his name to Max Power.
Max Power Way. I was pleased to find out that certain people's names were totally fake, like Carmen Electra. Of course, that's
yes.
famous. You think about it for a second, you know, the Carmen Electra.
And if it weren't, then it's fate.
Right. Wow. Diablo Cody. Of course. What were you thinking, Glenn, that somebody would actually be named Diablo Cody? But a lot of authors. I mean, you probably know that these were pseudonyms, but I mean, some of these I didn't. Flann O'Brien, George Eliot, George Orwell, Mark Twain, of course, George Sand, Hergé, Herblock, Stanley, Jack Kirby, John le Carré, Joseph Conrad, Lewis Carroll, Molière. Guy has one name like Cher. Of course. Come on. Pablo Neruda. Didn't know that. Oh. O. Henry, Robert Jordan, Sidney Sheldon, Voltaire, Woody Allen, Ayn Rand, Nicolas Cage. Also not a...
and you have lots and lots and lots and lots of actors and performers.
Portman. Yeah. Vin Diesel is a fake name. Go figure.
Shocker. And one more that is more in the realm of the disguise. Banksy.
Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
A lot of graffiti artists.
Yeah. Yeah, for some reason.
Some reason they're hiding their identity.
Cool Disco Dan.
DC shout out.
Nice. All right, if you have your own favorite pseudonym or story related thereto, go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/PCHH. This brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy? Trey Graham, what is making you happy?
You're going to think this is sick and twisted, but I'm actually quite serious about it. It was announced today, the news was released today, that the coroner's report for Corey Monteith showed that he died of an accidental overdose of heroin mixed with alcohol. His death was unexpected, of course, and really, really sad. I didn't know that his life had been quite as rough as it turned out to have been. Mm-hmm. And so what's making me happy this week is that he had a moment in the spotlight before he flamed out. It touches me somehow that this kid was able to sort of grab hold of the brass ring for however briefly he was able to hold on to it, and to find a welcome in a world that seemed to not welcome him for a while. So that's it.
Yeah, and there have been some very kind remembrances of him, you know, as people look back. And, you know, it's an incredibly sad story.
Yeah.
But so that's what's making you happy this week.
Yeah.
That's a perspective.
Right.
Is what's making
exactly.
Trey happy this week. Glenn Weldon, what do you got?
You're catching me between two fun things. I read at Politics and Prose last week, and it was a lot of fun, and people did show up, and I had to bring new chairs. I had to get chairs.
Yeah, no, cool. I saw them. I saw them hauling out the
nice.
Extra chairs.
It was very cool. And I am headed tomorrow, first thing in the morning, to San Diego Comic-Con for the first time, and that will be fun. But the main thing that's making me happy is that Jim Steranko is on Twitter. Jim Steranko is a legendary comic book artist and writer, made his name many ways, but he's known for Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Strange
Sweet.
Tales. He is known for injecting a sort of visionary, you might call it psychedelic, you will certainly call it surreal quality to his pages, and he looks great. 74 years old dude. His Twitter icon is of him. A very recent picture at the New York Comic Con. Tan, huge shock of white hair, aviator frames, blue blazer. I'm thinking it's a mock turtleneck. And what he does is he sends out these bursts of tweet. He's telling stories about the comic book industry in discrete bursts. And then he shuts up for a while, which is perfect. It's like a great way of just telling a complete story. And you can't, when you see this guy and you hear these stories, you kind of can't hear them without hearing the voice of Robert Evans in your head. Jessica, do you know who Robert Evans is?
No.
Okay. Jessica, Robert Evans is
I've
a...
tuned out.
Is a of course you have. Why should you be any different? Robert Evans is a producer immortalized in the documentary...
The Kid Stays in the Picture.
The Kid Stays in the Picture. Mm. Kid Stays in the Picture. And he's got this kind of croaky voice, and he's just a born storyteller, but he shares this same aesthetic with the aviator sunglasses and the he's basically a human pinky ring.
That does.
Oh, perfect.
So I'm going to really briefly tell you this one story that he told about meeting Bob Kane at a con. Now, Bob Kane is credited with creating Batman. However, people like Bill Finger had a much bigger role in creating Batman, and people like Jerry Robinson and Dick Spranger also in that mix in a big way, and Bob Kane famously dissed them and downplayed their importance. So, I hadn't encountered Kane in my travels, but it's one rockin' SDCC, San Diego Comic-Con, an associate asked me if I wanted to meet him and walked me into a hallway. There he was in a small group of people wearing patent leather shoes and an ascot, like he was vitamin-effing Flint Heart in a Dick Tracy cartoon. For years, I'd heard how he'd taken credit for Bill Finger's contribution in addition to half his pay and other despicable tales from his associates. But nothing aces an in-person encounter. We were introduced, and Kane began talking about my Batman chapter in the History of Comics. He wrote a very famous History of Comics, which treated him and everyone else very respectfully. He felt I credited Jerry Robinson and Bill Finger, both of whom I knew intimately, too much. Kane, a.k.a. Khan, bringing in a little Wrath of Khan there. It's color coming from.
This is all on Twitter.
This is all on a kind of Twitter.
Is it like one of 10?
So it's one of about 40.
Okay. He's written it out and he's cutting and pasting it in. Yes. 140 character chunks.
Kane was beyond pretentious and intolerable ass, as pompous as they come. I bit my tongue while he regaled us with his many achievements. The group was waiting for an elevator, which they stepped into when the door opened. A conversation ended, but not before he said, "See you later, Jim, baby," and cuffed me across the face like some Rat Pack street jester he'd seen in some cheap flick. The doors closed. I was stunned by the sheer audacity of a stranger like him to lay a hand on me. And boiling with anger, that night I couldn't sleep, and the next morning began combing the halls for his Bat Majesty. It's my favorite part. It's my favorite part right there. Around noon, I found him in another group, which I walked into. "Good to see you, Bob, baby," I said, then bitch-slapped him across the face. But this time there was no elevator door closing between us. I stood there for about 15 seconds waiting. He did nothing. I turned and left, but I regret it now. I regret that he didn't do anything about it, even though he was at least a head taller than me. I wouldn't have minded bleeding at all for one more opportunity to give Kane the kind of bat lesson. See what he's doing there? Bat lesson that Finger, Robinson, Sprang, and others only dreamed of. Now, let's stipulate that the choice of the phrase bitch slap is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. He's a 74-year-old dude. We have to kind of allow that. Mm-hmm. But, man, so if you... I think you have to love or at least know comics to get the full extent of this thing. But, man, this is some ace, wonderful tweeting, and it's history, and it's color.
It is color.
Now, did you paste those all together?
I did paste them all together.
Okay.
Wow. So he's at I am Steranko, all together, Steranko. I am Steranko.
Very good, right. Glenn. Jim Steranko on Twitter.
I need a bonus round, since Glenn came with the lively and mentioned history. It reminded me of something that I wanted to say in our first segment, but didn't get around to. Mm-hmm. One of the things making me happy is that Orange is the New Black is giving the younger generation, like Jess Gittner, the opportunity to meet Leah Delaria. Right. She is an actress, comedian, and jazz and blues singer who is in Orange is the New Black, playing a character named Carrie Big Boo Black. She is, if you're having trouble placing her, she's the one who warms up the corn on the cob in her bra.
Right.
In episode 2, I think. And she was the first out queer stand-up comic to do a late-night talk show. She was on Arsenio in 1993. She hosted Comedy Central's first all-gay comedy special, and she is a badass. She also she played Hildy the Taxi Driver, I think, in a Broadway revival of On the Town, if I've got my Broadway shows right. And like I said, she is a serious, serious jazz and blues singer. Her version of I Can Cook Too will steam your rice.
One of many amazing actors on that freaking show. Yeah. Oh, my God, I love that show. Thank you, Trey.
You're welcome.
Jess Gittner, what do you got?
Well, of course, Orange is the New Black is making me happy, and I could talk about that a lot more. Feel free to get in touch on Twitter. But another thing making me happy is a project by Miranda July, who's done some work in film and has written a book Her project is called We Think Alone, and it's 20 weeks of sort of like an email digest sent out. It's now on week 3 on various topics, and these are emails that her friends have forwarded to her. So the people include Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Lena Dunham, Kirsten Dunst, and some other artist types. So far the topics have been an email about advice, an email about money. This last week was an email that mentions Obama. And I love, love, love email. I love sending emails to my friends. I love receiving emails. I like, you know, expressing myself via Gmail.
I thought all you young kids were into the Snapchat and the tweets
the
and the
vines.
And the vines today.
Love a good email. And so I really enjoyed reading these. As I am a millennial, I have chosen one from Lena Dunham. And this is from an email that gives advice from week 2. This was written in February of 2012. And it just says 2K. Everyone who it's addressed to is anonymous. And she says, "Listen to me. I'm a woman who loves and adores and I believe understands you. You did nothing wrong. He is not nice. He says not nice things in a nice voice, so they seem nice, but they are not. He isn't kind or careful with you. He wants to suck the kindness out of you. And if he's like this after 10 years of group therapy, then God help us all." And she continues on and gives her friend advice. Then later on it says, "Note. Kirsten Dunst was unable to locate an email that gives advice." I thought that I enjoyed that. Everyone was joking about it on Twitter, or the people who signed up, and Miranda July did not take kindly to that for some reason. But I just thought that was funny. They're very random. They're just delightful, and it's a cool project. And you could sign Google We Think Alone, and you could sign up, send your email in, and you will get these weekly digests. Another piece of news here. This is my second to last week producing Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Penultimate.
Ugh. Penultimate.
Thompson.
This is not making me happy.
You've run off another one?
they eventually flee. Yeah, Jess.
It's certainly not the thing that's making me happy. However, I am happy to be presumably joining the Daywalkers.
Soon you will know the sting of the sun.
Yeah. So, Midwesterners, I will be joining you for the first time in the great, I hear, city of St. Louis come August. So,
if you are in St. Louis and would like to be Jess Gittner's friend, please
email.
She prefers email
her
email.
At jessneedsfriends@.
Thank you, Jess. We will miss you dearly. We will, I'm sure, speak more of this in next week, your ultimate appearance.
Yes.
No, she's dead to us.
Judas!
No.
Judas!
No, we love all of our producers, and you have done an absolutely tremendous job on our show, and we adore you, and we'll miss you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, on that sour note, I have so little that's making me happy. I wanted to offer one brief apology. We talked about trilogies in our last episode, and I sort of said, I can't really think of too many music trilogies. And, of course, on our Facebook page and on Twitter, everybody's like, "Durr." And I can't believe, I just want to point out, that I managed to not mention Robin's Body Talk trilogy.
I had forgotten about that,
and
too.
And how did Jess Gittner not leap through the producer's glass to throttle me for forgetting it? So apologies to Robin and her fans. We are recording this on July 16th, which is the actual 3-year anniversary of Pop Culture Happy. I forgot last week to remind people, especially new listeners in the last year, that if you go to popculturehappyhour.wordpress.com, you may download a PDF of a 7,000-word essay I once wrote about Team Onion softball, which I had completely forgotten was still on the internet. I mean, I wrote it, so I can't recommend it, but I ask if you...
can recommend it. It is officially recommended.
Thank you, Glenn. That's making me happy. Finally, I was on vacation for much of last week. We recorded the show, and I immediately hopped in my minivan and drove back to my hometown of Iola, Wisconsin. And I wanted to shout out a fellow native of Iola, Wisconsin named Austin Lane. Austin Lane is a football player, an NFL player, formerly of the Jacksonville Jaguars, and now now with Mike Katziff's Kansas City Chiefs, which he recently joined. And Iola, Wisconsin is a town of 1,300 people. So the likelihood of making it in the National Football League as a native of Iola, Wisconsin are vanishingly small. And what is making me happy is that at the beginning of last week, Austin Lane, who is very funny on Twitter, a very smart guy, got the assignment to write an incredibly high-profile column on Sports Illustrated's website called Monday Morning Quarterback. It's usually written by Peter King. And he's charming. He's funny. He's delightful. I've been following him on Twitter for ages. He's very witty and clever and silly, and it's just enormously delightful to be immediately relegated to the second best-known writer to attend Iola Scandinavia High School in Iola, Wisconsin. Austin Lane, you can follow him on Twitter at A-Train-92, A_Train_92, Austin Lane, doing Iola, Wisconsin proud. And that's what's making me happy this week, and that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me, your thankfully temporary host, at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey Graham at Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon. You can follow Jess Gittner at Jess Gittner, GITNER. You can follow our absent host, Linda Holmes, at NPR Monkey C. And you can follow our esteemed music director and producer emeritus, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and we will see you here next week.